All right, Erev Tov, welcome to part three of Great Rabbis of the 20th Century. Tonight, we'll look at the life and Torah of Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, the Altus Lubotka, was sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Ilu Nishmas Yona, Ben Rav Aryeh Leib. I've noted a few times it seems strange to include in this series someone who died in 1928, with barely a quarter of the 20th century completed. That's until we realize that Rav Nosson Tzvi was the Rebbe of so many of the great Rosh Yeshiva of the century. People like, and there's just a partial list, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Yaakov Ruderman, Rav David Leibovich, Rav Yitzhak Kutner, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, Rav Yecheskel Sarna, Rav Aaron Kalmanovich, not to mention his own son, Eliezer Yehuda Finkel. So just to make it more understandable, just in terms of places, you're talking about Lakewood, Tor Vidas, Ner Yisrael, Chafetz Chaim, Chaim Berlin, Rav Weimar Sridi Esh was a Rashiv in Montreux in Switzerland, Rav Yecheskel Sarna was the Chevron Yeshiva after the Alta died, when they moved to Chevron, and Mir, and others. It's just a partial list, and that is astonishing. It's even more astounding. What's even more astounding is that Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel was not their Rosh Yeshiva. As founder of the yeshiva in Slobodka, he almost never served as Rosh Yeshiva and almost never gave a regular Gemara shir, as you would expect. Instead, he held a position as Menahel, as Mashgiach, as Mashpia. He was in charge of the administration, of recruitment, of curriculum, but above all, his influence was in his shmuas, his Musar talks, that he gave regularly to the Bacharim and to the Musar method that he pioneered. The way the Chafetz Chaim put it enigmatically is the way the Alta can be best understood. Ask the difference between himself, the Chafetz Chaim, and the Alta Slobodka. The Chafetz Chaim reportedly said, "I write books, he creates people, mention." And that explains why the Alta was successful and raises the one tantalizing question to which we all want to know the answer. How does one create people? How do you make mention? How do you make leaders? Wouldn't we all like to know? Well, that's the story of the Alta of Slobodka. So Alta was born in 1849 in Resign in Lithuania, not far from Prussian, I should say. He was orphaned while still a child and was raised by his uncle in Vilna, and already was acknowledged as an Eloi, a genius, at a young age. He married before he was 20 to the granddaughter of the Rav of Resign, and he began learning in his father-in-law's home and also became a traveling Magid, a very popular traveling Magid, until he was brought to the attention of Rav Simcha Zissel Ziv, the Altar of Kelm. Kelm was also not far from Resign. And he began learning in his father-in-law's home. The Altar then, Altar of Kelm, Rav Simcha Zissel, was one of the three main disciples of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And he had adopted Rabbi Yisrael's methods and focus on personal, ethical, and moral development, the systematic study and practice of Musar. Of course, Musar always existed to an extent. Everyone learned the Chavos HaLevavos and Shari Tshuva and Mesuzas Yesharim, etc. But what Rabbi Yisrael did and what in Kelm they established was that it should be studied systematically, like one studies any other area of Torah. So the Altar of Kelm founded what was called the Beis HaTalmud in Kelm, and Rav Nosson Tzvi learned there, and his Hasmada was legendary. And not much older than 20 years, the Alt of Kelm brought in Rav Nosson Tzvi into the management of the yeshiva. So Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel became the Alt's assistant, and he taught in the Beis HaTalmud. He even moved with the yeshiva from Kelm to Grubin when the yeshiva closed in 1876. He didn't last there very long. The Alt of Slobodka, had very definite ideas about chinuch, about curriculum, even the purpose of education, and he differed with the Alt of Kelm, Rav Simcha Zissel, in a number of ways, as we'll see. And he perceived generally that in Lithuania there was a lot of learning going on, a lot of Torah learning, but it was a bit unfocused and disordered, and the very talented student could easily become disenchanted. The great yeshiva in Volozhin, the Ema Yeshiva, was the exception. In most places where these little yeshivas existed, students were dirt poor, they were scrounged for their daily bread, they would eat at different homes every day or simply not eat at all, wear raggedy clothing, living in dilapidated conditions, sleeping on the hard benches in the town shuls. Not pleasant. And the Beit Noir of the generation was the Haskalah, the enlightenment that beckoned the bright young Jew with the lure of the modern world, the chance to broaden his mind, and sometimes even escape poverty and repression. The problem was the consequences. It wasn't necessary to abandon Torah and mitzvos to become a maskil. It just happened invariably. So Rav Nosson Zvi set out to change all that, and what he wanted to do was to build a Volozhin where the students also focused on Musar, and not only Gemara and Halacha. So Musar was controversial, and always was, in a milieu where everything that was not Torah only was suspected of being a furtive way to sneak in the Haskalah or otherwise weaken Torah. So Musar had many, many detractors. When the yeshiva system began to develop more systematically in the late 1800s, the yeshivas that refused him entree, refused to consider his approach. Volozhin was one, to take a famous example. Reb Chaim Brisker was a bitter opponent of Musar. He looked at the program and he said, in essence, that Musar is for people who are ill. In Volozhin, later in Brisk, he said, we're healthy, we don't need it. He meant spiritually ill. The spiritually healthy don't need it. The thinking of Reb Chaim was that Talmud Torah on its own would produce moral, decent people. And that's generally true, but as we know, it's not only true. Always true. The Gemara already mentions, the Gemara in Yoma, Daf Ayin Beis Amud Beis, that lo zocho nasis lo sam misa. If a person is not worthy, then the Torah for him can become a poison, a means to corruption and not to betterment. Or the Gemara in Sota, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, kevon shenichnasa chochma ba'adam. When a person gains a little wisdom, Rashi's a little Torah, nichnasa imo armumis, he acquires also some deviousness, some cleverness. So Torah knowledge does not always go hand in hand with moral virtue, even though it should. Reb Chaim never saw that, understandably so. So the Alta said about Reb Chaim, that Reb Chaim is the biggest Bal Musar in the world, he just doesn't know it. In 1877-78, and with a stipend from a wealthy Berlin Jew named Ovadia Lachman, Reb Nosson Zvi founded his yeshiva in Slobodka. It's a close suburb right across the Neris River from Kovno, which was then the capital of Lithuania. Reb Nosson Zvi, for monetary reasons, actually attached himself to an existing yeshiva, Eitz HaChaim, under the leadership of Rav Hirsch Levitan, and he became the mashgiach there, introducing Musar ideals. And he also tried to help other yeshivos start, thinking those would be the foundation of what he wanted to do, like the Kolel Purushim in Kovno, that was started by the Kovno Rav, famous Kovno Rav, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. And then he served together with another Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser, Rabbi Itzla Petterberger. In that time, he published anonymously a sefer called Eitz Pri, with articles in it from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rabbi Yitzchak Spector, and others, and he was active in founding similar kolim throughout Lithuania. And Reb Nosson Zvi was fond of quoting the Medrash, the Yalkut Shimoni and Shoftim, Samaches, that says that 72,000 Jews were killed in the Pilegesh Vegeva debacle in the Book of Shoftim, because the Sanhedrin should have lifted up their robes, I'm quoting the Medrash now, they should have lifted up their robes and traveled across the land of Israel the entire year, one day in Beit El, one day in Lachish, until the Jews were spiritually settled in their land. But they didn't. And the Medrash says, Haim lo asu kein. Sanhedrin didn't. They sat in one place. Kevan shenichnasu Yisrael la'artzam. Once we enter the land of Israel, kol echad ve'echad rotz l'karmo l'zeiso. Everyone ran to his own vineyard, his own olive grove, and said, shalom alai nafshi. As long as there's peace with me, as long as I'm righteous and learn, I have time, I don't have to get involved with anybody else. Shalom l'harbos ha'torach. Not to involve themselves in others' spiritual problems or needs. Reb Nosson Tzvi saw that as a problem of his generation as well, and therefore the mandate of the generation would be to spread Torah into every town and to every person, because otherwise Torah and the people would be lost. And that became his primary objective, not just teaching Torah and Musar to students, but creating leaders who would go out across the Jewish world. In the early years of Slobodka, he lived with the students in the yeshiva. His wife remained in Kelm and ran a grocery store. She was self-supporting. So an unusual relationship. He had little, he wanted little, he took no money from the yeshiva. He would go out to eat just like they did. He would visit home twice a year, Nisan and before Yom Kippur through Sukkot. He would cry when asking his wife for mechila before Yom HaKippurim, because he knew that the sacrifice that she was making, and he wouldn't leave after Sukkot until he felt that she had sincerely forgiven him. She eventually did join him in Slobodka in 1906. The nucleus of his yeshiva in Slobodka was really established in 1882. He had been teaching Musar to students who gathered in his room. But once yeshiva was formally opened, he brought in distinguished rabbonim to give shiurim and even to serve as Rosh Yeshiva. And he concentrated on administration, on recruitment, on teaching Musar. The yeshiva's heyday really began when Volozhin closed in 1892 as a result of internal strife and external pressures. With Volozhin closing, some more students came. Reb Itzel of Petterburg came to teach there. Other Gedolim came to teach. And already Slobodka became a shame dover. The pattern was established. Torah on the highest level and Musar on the highest level. That is to say, the full development of the intellect as well as the character of the student. Make no mistake, for most of the time, the yeshiva was poor. Every student got 1.5 liters of bread every day, and that's it. On Shabbos, they ate out. But the yeshiva was always in debt, and this became Reb Nosson Tzvi's burden, and most of the support in those years still came from Mr. Lachman, but it was never enough. In 1894, he brought in 2 Rosh Yeshiva brothers-in-law, Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein and Reb Issa Zalman Meltzer, both legendary names, brothers-in-law by no accident. They never met their father-in-law, Reb Shraga Feivel Frank, who was a wealthy fur merchant. He died age 43, and he directed in his will that his wife marry off their 4 daughters only to men who had the potential to be Gedolei Yisrael. So 2 were these Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein, Reb Yisrael Meltzer. Another was, all became great Rosh Yeshiva. A third was Reb Shefla Kramer, Saudi Yeshiva New Haven in the 1920s. The latter, Reb Yisrael Zalman, stayed only 4 years, and then he made his reputation as the Rav of Slutsk, and then, of course, Reb Yeshiva Yitzchaim in Yerushalayim. He was the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler, the grandfather-in-law of Rav Yehuda Amital. And here, Rav Meltzer was the Rebbe of such luminaries and different personalities as Rav Shlomo Gorin, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Eliezer Monshach, Rav Henkin, and others. Meanwhile, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein remained at the Rosh Yeshiva in Slobodka, and there he remained. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, and he and the Alta worked together for decades. He also became Michutanim. The acrimony over Musa never really ended, and it makes for some bizarre stories. Yeshiva was forced to break up, split, in 1897 when a group of students rebelled against the Musa emphasis. Remember, there'd been influx from Volozhin, so they weren't used to this. So they were, if you can imagine, fist fights, benches thrown in the base medrash, Musa's farm were desecrated. It's hard to imagine. As a result, a new yeshiva was created and was called Knesset Yitzchak, named after Rabbi Yitzchak, named after Itzi Spilzinger. Could be. Named after, had they known, only had they known. It was named after the Kovno Rav, or Yitzchak Hanus Spector, who had just died that year. The Alter called his yeshiva Knesset Yisrael after Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Note, people often speak of the Slobodka yeshiva, but you have to clarify, they're really two different yeshivas. The truth is, in terms of the names, it became a pattern that infiltrated our world as well. There are those who say, another yeshiva opened 1897, familiar to us, Reitz. Why was it named after Yitzchak Hanun? He died. But the argument is, the founders of Reitz wanted to make a clear statement that it's a non-Musi yeshiva. See, named after the Kovno Rav, as opposed to Ner Yisrael, for example, was named after Yisrael Salanter, to make the statement that this will be a Musi yeshiva. Yeshiva Salanter, the Bronx, where I studied in my early youth, as my brother did as well, it was meant to be a yeshiva where they emphasized Musar. I'm not sure it's carried over to SAR necessarily, the name has, but I'm not sure Yisrael's approach has. But nonetheless, it wasn't the only time there were these rebellions in the yeshiva, as the altar always attracted strong, independent, creative young men, and he had respect for that. So interesting. The story is told, so he did all the recruitment, and people came by the hundreds. They wanted to learn in Slobodka. A father came with his son, who was 12 years old, but a genius, as happened in those days, to learn in Slobodka. And the altar wanted always to test the mettle of the student. So he said to the father in the presence of the young man, how old is he? So the father said, he's 12. So the altar said, did you bring his crib with you? Meaning he's too young to be there. So the boy said, why, do you lack people for a minion here? Meaning he's not bar mitzvah yet. Is that you need me to make up a minion? And the altar respected the retort and admitted him, and of course he became a great Rosh Yeshiva as well, maybe one of the ones that I mentioned. Over time, typically the altar did what he could do to smooth the tensions between the yeshivas. He even became involved behind the scenes in helping Knesset Yitzchak, so for most of the time, the two schools had cordial relations. Some students, like Avraham Cutler, for example, would go back and forth between the two, especially when Baruch Ber Leibovich, one of Chaim's great Talmidim, became a Shiv Knesset Yitzchak. Many of the Talmidim just go there to hear Shiurim, and so they really worked in concert. The Alter remained in Slobodka until World War I, but he established Slobodka branches or wings throughout Lithuania. And this is pretty rare, because it was considered an elite establishment. He would routinely, upon request, dispatch groups of Talmidim to move and learn in other towns to bolster the yeshivos there. And that's how great yeshivos started or were strengthened. Telz, Lodz, Brisk, Mir, Radin, elsewhere. A Rosh Yeshiva, a town Rav, would make a request, and the Alter would send 10 of his best Talmidim, a dozen of his best Talmidim, who were known as the cream of the crop. During World War I, he fled first to Germany, where he was imprisoned. And unbeknownst to him, he was protected by a German soldier who would bring him special food and make sure he came to no harm. And the Alter had no idea why, until after the war, this German officer wrote to him that he had learned in Slobodka many years earlier. He gained tremendously from the altar, but did not want to come into his orbit, for reasons we'll see. But he was now repaying his debt to the altar for the influence he had on his life. He returns to Slobodka after the war, and in 1924, the altar orchestrated one of the most prescient and remarkable moves ever. After the Soviets decreed that all students, even older ones, had to be drafted into the Soviet army, the Alter left with 100 students and relocated to Hebron, Ir HaKodesh. They all made Aliyah. The rest of the yeshiva remained, but it was the first such instance of a yeshiva making Aliyah en masse. and to the altar, and a tremendous love of Eretz Yisrael that comes through in his statements when he lived there. The altar was a fulfillment of the Gemara in Megillah and of Chavtesa and Aleph. Asid in Bote Kinesios and Bote Midrasha Shebebavel Sheyi Kavu Beret Yisrael. In the future, all the shuls in Bote Medrash in the exile will be reestablished in the land of Israel. And that's what he did with Slobodka in the city of Hebron. We'll return to that part of the story. I want to focus on the methodology of the altar. The heyday of Slobodka was in those years, 1897 to 1924, and all the giants I mentioned at the beginning learned there in this era, sometimes overlapping with each other, but not always. So how did he do it? What was his methodology? Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky summarized it as follows. He said, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein is my Rebbe in learning. The altar is my Rebbe in life matters. He was the Rebbe who taught them how to live, what life was supposed to be. And of course, echoing the words of the Ramchal at the beginning of Mesillas Yesharim, that the foundation of all piety, the root of service of God, pure service of God, Hushay Yisbar V'Yisames Eitzel Ha'odom Macho V'So Be'olamo, that a person has to clarify and internalize what is our obligation in the world, why are we here, what should we be doing? The altar's approach was unique, and it was a dramatic departure from the way the original Musar movement had developed. His approach can be summarized in the phrase, Gadlus Ha'adam, the greatness of man. Now, Musar had generally focused on man's lowliness, made famous by the altar of Navardak. Everyone is old, apparently. The altar of Navardak, Rabbi Yosef Yosel Horowitz, and his Shiflus Ha'adam program, meaning the altar of Navardak emphasized people's lowliness, how we're so prone to sin, how our souls can be sullied and besmirched so easily. So in Navardak, they became well known for the methods they used to debase themselves. Famous stories. Going to a hardware store and asking the proprietor for a dozen eggs. So the proprietor should say, you're an idiot, get out of here. We don't sell eggs in a hardware store. They prided themselves, it was the most famous story of Navardak. They prided themselves on being nothing, garnish. The famous anecdote, they sit in the Beis Medr, in the Beis HaMusar, and repeat to themselves, Ich bin a garnish, I'm nothing. So one day, a new student walks in, sits down, sees what's going on, and he starts saying, Ich bin a garnish, I'm nothing. At that point, a veteran Talmud says to his friend, look at this guy, he's here for 5 minutes, already he thinks he's nothing. Whatever the joke, the truth was that Musar, as it was practiced before the altar, and as it was studied, could be foreboding, depressing, reminding man constantly of sin, death, lowliness, unworthiness. That was the dominant style. So Rav Kook, for one, opposed Musar as too depressing, as robbing life of its natural joy. If in Kelm, with Rav Simcha Zissel, the emphasis was on Torat HaNefesh, studying the soul, and how easy it is to contaminate the soul. And so Musa was an endless battle against failure and impurity. In Slobodka, the emphasis was on Torat HaAdam, and the greatness that inheres in man. The Alta slant was exactly opposite of Navardak. Godless Adam, man is great, created itself Elohim, in the image of God. So man should always behave and act like a being created B'Tzelem Elohim. And as such a creature, man must show honor to others who are also created B'Tzelem Elohim. And do chesed, because he's thereby honoring God, and is demonstrated in many ways. So if you look at the reader we have tonight, I have a number of citations. The Alta never wrote anything. There are a number of publications of his Shmuos. One called Or HaTzafun, the light of the hidden, or the hidden light. Note, hey, tzadi, fe, nun. Hirsch, who's called in Yiddish, not the Hirsch. Hirsch, Zvi, Finkel, Nasan. Or Atzafun, but of course means the hidden light. He was extracting hidden things from the Torah. So in Tanuat HaMusar, Rav Dov Katz writes, the whole Chayil Gimel is devoted to the altar, by the way. Lefi mikra da Torah shebektav al peh, according to the source in the Torah, written in oral, Nivra Adam Rishon, Adam was created, as Rav Nosson Svi taught it, bidmut niflavin is gava ma'od ma'od, as a lofty, wondrous figure. Something that's far removed from our understanding. The pasuk says, "Vayivra Elokim es Adam etzalmo, betzalmo Elokim bara oto." Man was created in the image of God. That itself testifies to how sublime man is. And this fact is repeated several times in the Torah. Ze sefer Torah told us Adam, biyombro Elokim Adam, bedmus Elokim asarso. Shofech dam adam ba'adam, you murder a person, damo yishofech. Ki betzem alakim asa adam. God made man in his image. You can't hang a convicted, executed felon on a tree for more than a moment. Ki kilas alakim taloi. At the end of the day, the worst Russia is also a tzem alakim. And if you look at his Shmuz number 2 in Arat Safun, Umaravu Chesed Hashem Hashem Bitziras Adam Shabrak Hanesh Baruch Hu Bitzalmo Bitzalmo Kim Elyon L'chol Nevrim. He said, man was created in God's image, and therefore he's supreme over all other beings. Agadol Afilu Min Amalachim, superior even to the angels. So the angels suggested man not be created, the Medrash that he quotes, and God said, no, he's created a being that's even superior to the angels. And you see, Adam Arishon Isigas Ma'asoshal Kol Nivra. Adam Arishon was so great, he was able to understand the essence of every creature, name everything, which the angels could not do. God created man to be the crown of creation. And therefore, we have to act like it. So what was godless Adam? Unusual for Eastern Europe. Hey, it could be for parts of New York as well. And New Jersey, students in Slobodka were always neat and well-dressed. Students in Slobodka, they would not take out their... most were not married. They would not take out their tzitzis for kriyashma, shachris. People do, kids do it all the time. Why? Alta said, it's not appropriate to mess up your clothing during davening and have your undershirt hanging out. They would not daven with a dangling sleeve or with a tefillin. They put their sleeve, they put their arm, the tefillin arm, back into the jacket. Because the Alta said, it's not respectful to daven before the King of Kings with your sleeve hanging. Students walked with erect posture. The clothing was spotless. Alta kicked out a kid, sent him back to his to the house he stayed in, who was missing a button on his jacket. To the Alta, that was unthinkable. It showed a lack of self-respect not to have your a button on a jacket. In the early days of the yeshiva, even had a tailor on the premises to mend garments. Every person to the altar, being at Selim Elokim, was worthy of respect. Every human being. Turn the page number 9. Again from Tanuat HaMusar. Rav Nosson Svi, Rabbi Zinu Kodach HaNasha, Yesh L'Nechais L'Chol Adam Kel Tzel Malakim. You have to relate to every human being as a Tzel Malakim. V'chol HaMeitiv Im Adam Kel Meitiv Im HaShechina Kivyachol. Whoever does something good for a person does something good, so to speak, for the Shechina as well. And anyone who harms a person or disrespects a person, it's like they're harming and disrespecting the Shechina also. And the Alta would emphasize this. So he could be caustic in teaching good midos, perhaps especially then to make a point. Disrespect to people, he would not tolerate. A Talmud once talking, and a Talmud said, what is Einstein? Nothing. Meaning that he's not involved in Torah, so what good is he? The Alta said to the Talmud, you're an idiot. And not only because of the disrespect, but because the person does not respect wisdom. He put tremendous emphasis on speech, lashon nekiya, proper language and approach. Very careful. The Slobodka Talmidim would speak deliberately. They would measure every word. They would make sure they use the right word in every occasion. So the Alter, for example, would never use the word dog, hund, because people used it as an insult to others. Instead, he would say the one who barks, the barker, you know, the creature that barks. Someone once asked Rav Simcha Wasserman, there's a Talmud there, the son of Rav Yochanan Wasserman, Shem Yikom Damo. Someone asked Rav Simcha, how's your father? And Simcha Wasserman answered, not bad. And the Alter took him aside and said to him, is that the way a person speaks about a father, especially a father as illustrious as yours? Like a person asks about a horse in the stable, how's the horse? And you say, not bad? Reb Simcha said, that's why I came to Slobodka. Because people say that here, one learns how to speak. So the Alter was not only creating people, more than even having Talmidim, he was creating leaders who would understand human nature and know how to interact with others and guide them properly. So for example, they live with families during the week, although they ate in the yeshiva, but the Alter insisted the Talmidim eat out on Shabbos. You couldn't eat in the yeshiva on Shabbos. They should see how a normal family functions, husband, wife, children. And Gadlus HaAdam meant that we should always have high expectations of ourselves. And sin was horrific, not because of Gehenim and dire punishments like the other Musar approaches taught, but because there's a degradation of man. When you're a prince, a servant of God, you're expected to act a certain way. And if you stumble, you should be embarrassed. In a famous quip I mentioned on Shabbos, the Alter said, I can't guarantee you that my students will never sin. I can guarantee that they will not enjoy it. They'll not enjoy it because they're supposed to be on a high level. So it's an elevated sense of conscience as well as an awareness that they're standing before the King of Kings. So the key was to develop Gadlus HaAdam, but without gaiva, without arrogance. Prior generations could indulge, he said, in acts of self-debasement, but he felt that this generation could not. So haughtiness could only be countered with an excess of Das Hashem, an excess of Musar. I always quoted the Pasuk in Ekev, V'ram levavecha v'shachach das Hashem elokecha. Your hearts will grow haughty and you'll forget God. But also that every single human being is Yitzir Kapov Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God's handiwork. And that people should say, Bishvili Nivra HaOlam, the world was created for me. Not to indulge their egos, but to engage their energy to serve other people. As if to say, Bishvili Nivra HaOlam, only I can do it, no one else. And the focal point of his Avodas Hashem was Chesed. The Alter excelled in Bikur Cholim, in Achnasas Orchim, in Tzedakah for the poor. He had no money of his own. For example, you know, they didn't have family days in the yeshiva or what do they call them today, timeouts, you know, take a day off. No, he had to commit to yeshiva and be there every day, 7 days a week. But there was one acceptable excuse for absence, Bikur Cholim. If you attending to a sick person, Alter said that trumped everything else. Chesed was at the root of what he taught. If we go back to our reader in number 3, again from Torah Musar, Ubiyot shetachli kabrio achesed, zasiba l'chol maseh breishit, olam chesed yibaneh, because chesed is the root of everything on which the world is founded, built, He til Kadosh Baruch Hu Adam Ba'olam Sheichilo Kimakom Tanugim Yidunim Ruchaniim Elyonim. The Alter saw that he perceived that God put man in a world that's filled with spiritual delights. Meaning, the other Bali Musa looked at the delights of the world as gashmi to bring people down spiritually, but he saw all these Tanugim in Yidunim, all these pleasures, all these enjoyments, as ways people could bestow them upon others and better the lives of others. So therefore, we are supposed to use our wisdom, our intelligence, and be able to bestow God's good on other people. Look at number 4. Mikam bar nasan svi lidei od chidush. Shekol akara elokit einam mitbateit ela bihitdamut lemidotav. Our recognition of God, our cognizance of God, is only expressed through imitating His ways. Now, it is revolutionary. Just think for Volozhin or Brisk, for example. Our hakara elokit, our recognition of God, is through the intellect. The Torah is Chochmas Hashem. So we want to imitate God, we want to come close to God, we do it through the intellect. The Alta hold, no, God is so removed from us. Eino guf, loisigo mismasiya guf. The Rambam says, God is not physical, so we can't have that attainment of God through the physical, and certainly His intellect is much superior to ours. The way that we can be, that we can imitate God, is only through imitating His ways. Mahu afata. If you want to identify with God, so you have to make your ani, your I, into His who. Meaning be exactly like Him. Do what He would do. Look at number 5. Again in the Orat Safun. Chesed hi anekuda sha'ela yirkezu kol ha'masim apulot. Chesed is the point which everything is every deed, every action is concentrated. Here, Matarat's the goal. Bat tamun sod gadlutos shel adam. There is hidden the great secret of man. Hevei domelo. Imitate God. Try to be like Him. And that's the Gemara in Shabbos. Mahunik rachum fatote rachum. Mahunik racham fatote chan, etc. Just like God is gomel chasodim, so should we be as well. Chesed hu ikar, hashoresh. Everything flows from doing chesed for other people. Have a domelo, aseato chesed, kemosha hakadosh baruch hu imcha. Do chesed for others like God does for you. Just turn the page for a second and he makes the point stronger. In fact, the first point, Artsafun, is where Avdov Katz quoted, Olam chesed yibone, that God created a world which gives us enormous opportunities to do good for other people who kibbutz emelokim. That's mahu afato. But you shouldn't think, therefore, that it's easy, take it for granted. Number 8, adayin lo tamu chasdei Hashem. The God's kindness to us is not ended, because He gave us bechira, that we should be able to choose between good and evil. We shouldn't think it's nahama de kisufa, the bread of shame, meaning a gift given to someone without any demands, any accountability. No, there are all these opportunities for chesed, but we still have to choose to do it. So bechira, free choice, is still another gift that God gave man. It's like being in a world, it's like a candy store filled with delights, and you get to distribute the candy to whoever you want. But you still have to do it. You have to seek ways to do it as well. To emphasize godless Adam, once a Talmud came from another yeshiva for a visit, and the Alta saw that he never smiled. He couldn't get him to smile. He tried any number of ways. He was not successful. The Alta's grandson was going back to the town whence this Talmud came, and the Alta did not let his grandson accompany this Talmud to the other town. Not being able to smile, he held, is a terrible character flaw. And his sensitivity to other people was exquisite. One Friday night, he was talking, as always, before Mairiv. He went on a little long. His wife and he lived at that time in a room in the yeshiva overlooking the Beis Medrash. His wife poked her head out of their room and just said, "They have wives." Old Talmidim have wives waiting for them at home. Right away he stopped. A student, you're thinking the same thing now, I bet. Right away he stopped. A student protested, "Our wives don't mind." The altar said, "First, you don't know that. And second, they're surely hungry and it's wrong to make them wait." Say, Davin Mairiv, and the altar ran out without even saying good Shabbos. They should get home to their families. Another time, he was traveling, went to shul, and Ovel Davin Mincha, and couldn't read. Massacred the Hebrew. People grumbled. The next day, the altar asked to Davin, and he stuttered the whole time. So they should forget about the fellow from the previous day. He should be embarrassed than the Avil a day before. He would daven a quick amida, so no one should have to wait for him. He once told a Talmud who was shuckling wildly in davening, remember, if you hit someone, you're a Rasha. It's the bucket. They didn't move. They didn't gesticulate. They stood like B'nai Adam, B'nai Milachim, before the King of Kings. The old way of Musa was to grow gradually, work on one character trait after another, ascending the ladder rung by rung, midah after midah. The Alter disagreed, and he said it was better to set a high target for which they would strive. Maybe then they'd attain half or a third. What shooting for the stars? It was quoted the famous comment in Eliyahu Rabbah. A person should always say, Masai Yagiu Masai L'Maasei Avosai Avram Yitzchak V'Yaakov. When will my deeds attain, touch, reach the same level as the deeds of the Avos? We may not be able to, but nonetheless, we set a high target. We'll certainly elevate ourselves above where we are now. Alter was a master of human nature. Rabbi Yaakov said he had a greater insight into psychology than Freud, who was a contemporary. He had an acute, razor-sharp insight into every student. He literally knew what made them tick and how to elicit the best qualities in each. In one famous story, there was a top student, an Eloi, a Masmid, good midos, a Yerei Shamayim, who came to learn Slabatka, and the Alter basically ignored him. He arrived at the same time with a friend as a student who was not that good at Talmud, wasn't so into the learning, and he wasn't so serious either. Every yeshiva has that too. So the Alter ignored the first, and he smothered the second one with attention. And the first grew to resent this treatment. Years later, the first was sitting Shiva for his father, and the Alter came to visit. And the fellow was surprised, because the Alter paid him no attention in Slabatka. And he took the opportunity of sitting Shiva to pour out his heart to the Alter. That all these years, he received no attention, and students who were far worse and not serious were lavish with attention. Talk to him. Alter would bring them into his home for meals. So he said, you never gave me the time of day, so why are you visiting me now? So you would think that the Alter said to him, they needed it. You didn't need it, and that's the difference, right? That's not what he said. You see his genius. Alter said to him, your whole world is Torah. Your world is Yiras Hashem, Avodas Hashem. So when you desire to give, that I should give you attention, that was the product of your Yetzer Hara. You wanted to hear from me praise and compliments to feed your ego. That I was unwilling to do. There's no value to it, and it could even harm you. But your friend, his whole world's about friends, about being social and other things, and not necessarily what you find in the Beis Medrash. So I brought him into my home, or he came to see me, he came to feed his Yetzer HaTov. He needed the excess of attention, so he should hear some Torah, hear some Musar, so I could try to develop his spiritual side. You wanted me for Yetzer Hara, so I didn't give it to you. But he wanted me for his Yetzer HaTov, and that's why I had to give it to him. And note, the former, this Talmud, who was rejected, became a big Rosh Yeshiva. And the latter became a major rabbi of a town. Each with different directions, but the Alter knew how to grow them in the right way. Now part of his greatness was his ability to let each student develop in accordance with his own personality. The Alter himself said, I don't have 300 students, I have 300 individuals. But what was even more remarkable is that each student thought he was embodying the Alter's personality. And each was, but with a different facet. So Yaakov Kamenetsky said, it's like one person saw him from the right, another from the left, one from the back, one from the front. Same person, but different views. And the same was true of the learning. There was no one Slobodka style. Each Talmud came, chose an elder Talmud to learn with, a Chavura to learn with that suited him, and that's how they learned. Like Rav Yisrael Salanter, he put tremendous emphasis on the unconscious, on recognizing the latent forces that operate on us and shape our deeds. His focus was on molding the inner world. Look at number 6, a brief statement from Tenuat HaMusar. B'milum Acherot, in other words, Ein lavo l'chinucho shel adam min achutz el apanim bilvad kin bikam min apanim el achutz. You have to educate people, not like even we do today, from the outside in. Tell them what to do and you'll shape their inner world. Alter said the opposite. Shape their inner world first. Work on midos. Let them understand why they're doing the things they do. What led them to say this, to do that, to think that. And then you'll be able to mold them in the proper way. As such, he would harp, and there's a lot of Mishurim like this, on the smallest deviations, and teach how they eventuated into great misdeeds. And his primary method was to use the lives of the ancients, the Avos and Imos, and trace their deeds, so we could see the slightest flaw, a flaw from their perspective, not from ours. It's almost a heightened sense of aver goras avera. He used to say he had only one musar shmus and other larishon. Of course it wasn't true, but everything stemmed from God's intention creating Adam. I'll give you an example. Small things. He was a master at darshaning the midrashim of Chazal that highlighted this. The stumbling in one midah. So we read in the Torah 2 weeks ago, Yaakov Avinu, Medrash says, was right in hiding Dina from Esav. So afraid Esav would want to marry her, but he put her in a box, the Bali Musar say, with too much enthusiasm. They give a clap on the box. Rashi says he hit her in a box. Esav shouldn't find her. What does that mean, he hit her in a box with a clap? It means that he was right in doing it, but there was also a little ego involved as well, as if he was gaining something on his older brother, not being fully forthright, and even in his own mind, showing a little superiority. Knew what happened? Dina soon escaped the box, to her detriment. We still eat darshan, we still pay a price for the 2 tears that Esav shed when he lost the brachos to Yaakov. He said Avram was the paragon of chesed, as we know. But, beginning of Vayera, everything he provided his guests with, by himself, God gave us directly. Me, bread, man, etc. Slav. But Avram said to his guests, the Malachim, Yukach noma atmayim, take water on your own. God gave us water indirectly in the Midbar. Not directly like the man, through a well, through a rock. He saw such little foibles in students and would call them aside, chide them gently, sometimes not so gently. So Talmud once dangled his sleeve, took his arm out of his jacket to put on his tefillin. Alas, it was Shabbos. No tefillin. An older student saw and gave a little smirk. The altar caught it. To him it was a major flaw. Miskaved beklon chavero. Even if you don't say anything, just a smirk, thinking you're better than him. 8 years later, the altar told the Talmud, he's been watching him now for 8 years since he saw that flaw, and he said, you still haven't rectified it. You have to work on that. It was a diagnosis. He had an uncanny and unfailing insight into his students' personalities. He knew exactly what to say to them. Every Erev Yom HaKippurim, students, past and present, and they had in the low thousands over the years, hundreds would come up to the altar Erev Yom HaKippurim to receive a bracha, a challenge, and a rebuke, each perfectly tailored to the student. And he never expelled a student. He was cautious on admission, but he never expelled a student. Not even the rebels. They're rebels from the Musar wars that he kept in the yeshiva. There were times when the Rosh Yeshiva would want to get rid of someone who just didn't belong. The altar never let them. He would always find some tzad zchus, some merit. He never gave up on a Talmud. Something that sadly we cannot say about yeshivas today, including the local ones. They give up quickly. Maybe that's why we don't produce young people like in Slobodka. He wouldn't accept everyone. And students would leave. He'd send them to other yeshivas to learn. But he would never expel a student. It was a student with no intellectual abilities at all. It was even a behavioral problem. All right? How he got in, who knows. But the Rashi wanted to throw him out. And the Alta said, no, he does favors for people. That selves a schus. He felt that expelling a student made him into a victim. According to the Medrash on Koheles, V'elokim yivakeshes nirdof. God seeks out justice for every underdog, all the pursued. Afilu tzadek rodev rasha. Even when the righteous pursue a rasha, God favors the rasha. He also had an amazing ability to guide each student into what was most productive for him. He would see their future, or what he thought their future would be, or should be. And this is the most controversial aspect of the Alter's derech. The Alter, it was known to all his students, was controlling. That's why the German soldier stayed out of his orbit, the one who saved him in World War I. He undertook to mold leaders, to shape their personalities and midos, and so he did things that were unconventional, certainly by today's standards, discomforting. We would never accept it today, but nonetheless, we can't judge him by today, I know it's the modern custom, but by his times. So I'll give an example. I'll give a few examples. Rabbi Yaakov Yitzchak Ruderman was a first cousin to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. They were named after the same grandfather. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was about a decade older. When Rav Ruderman was young, he was not as serious a student in learning. By young, I mean less than 10. And his father would always challenge him in what he thought was a productive way. Why can't you learn like your cousin Yaakov? All right? Rabbi Yaakov Ruderman came to Slobodka like his cousin did. Rabbi Yaakov was already older. Rabbi Yaakov Ruderman became a masmid gadol in Slobodka, proving his father wrong. But so much so that Rav Ruderman's father died 1 year after Sukkos, and the Alter didn't tell him until right before Pesach. Bittul Torah. It would harm him as a masmid. So too, Reb Reuven Grozovsky, another Talmud, he never told that his father died until months later, and he said, why? So he should say Kaddish? He says Yiskadel V'Yiskadesh 24 hours a day. And he held the Talmud Torah of Yasum is greater than Kaddish. And it goes out saying that the Alter was orphaned as a child, so think of the dynamic here. How did he know all of this? Because he opened their mail, holding sincerely that it was for their own good. So in fact, he wasn't successful with every Talmud. And he attracted the best and the brightest. Some would go their own way, in different ways. Shaul Lieberman, a JTS, was a Talmud. Harry Wolfson started the Jewish Studies program at Harvard. He became a Talmud. You have literally dozens of town rabbis stretched out in America from coast to coast in the first 4 or 5 decades of the 20th century. Dozens who were Talmidim in Slobodka. And the great boogeyman that hovered over everything was the Haskalah. Haskalah loomed large. The university beckoned, and especially beckoned these students who were the brightest Jews of the day. So, for example, the Alter feared that the Sri Deish, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, was heading to university. Couldn't stop him. So he talked him into getting married to the daughter of the Rav of Pilvashuk, who had just died. Meaning he'd marry this woman, girl, and become the Rav of the town, and he wouldn't go to university. See, he did. He married her. He was 26. She was 16. Not quite Alabama, but all right, close to it. But the Sri Deish felt forced into the marriage. Was never happy. They separated when World War I broke out, and they finally divorced in 1922. They lived together all of 7 years, and he never married again, the Sri Deish. No children. He had a difficult life, made more difficult by the Holocaust. And in the end, he got a doctorate anyway from the University of Gießen. But he became Rosh Yeshiva. And remarkably, he bore no grudge against the Alter, because he felt the Alter knew him, had his best interest at heart, and set him on his derech. And we don't realize the lure of the outside world worse even than today. For example, of all his siblings, only Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky remained religious. And he had siblings who survived him. He died in the mid-1980s in Soviet Russia. Rav Aaron Cutler is the same story. He had a sister who came to America, not from. He's a math genius who later became a math professor at City College, who lamented what her brother, Rav Aaron Cutler, had become. He said he's a kleina Rosh Yeshiva when he could have been a world-famous mathematician. And according to legend, the altar personally ran down himself to the train station to stop Rav Aaron Cutler from leaving Slobodka to go to the University of Moscow. Bring him back to yeshiva. And perhaps it makes Rav Aaron's aversion to college more understandable. We should be careful before we sit in judgment. Desperate times call for desperate measures. But look at the successes. You could fall out of grace with him. He wouldn't talk to you for months at a time. But you could win your way back if he became aware of some act of chesed that you did. He was very makpid on etiquette, on normal behavior, but all as a sign that a person is in control of himself, of every action, every emotion, every thought. This is not Slobodka, but Kelm. I remember hearing years ago, someone walks in, David just walked in. So natural tendency of someone is to look at the door. In Kelm, they would harangue a Talmud who looked at a door to see who was coming into the room, because it meant that you weren't paying attention. You weren't focused on what you're supposed to be doing. You're so easily distracted. Small things meant a lot. Look at number 10. So he was medaktek, gam ba'alichotem animusiyot shel talmidim. He was very careful, very strict about the etiquette, the ways, the interactions of all his talmidim, especially the young ones, the tironim. Every movement they made, standing, walking, how they moved their arms, to swing your leg, to swing your... Anything that was done, that was not done with thought, with forethought, was rashlanut, laziness, itasumat lev, inattention, chosei yitzivut, instability. If you are in control of yourself, means you're in control of every single action that you do. And therefore, there's a heightened awareness. He says in number 11, as a very good example, things that we do for hergel v'shigra, just out of routine, are holy acts. For example, we bathe every day. But the Gemara says, Rochetz Adam Panav Yadav Rabbechoy Mishvil Kono. We're supposed to bathe every day, not to feel clean, but for God, for our Creator. It's an embarrassment. Creator should have a dirty vessel. So a person should think, he's about to shower, l'chvod kono, in honor of my Creator, I am about to bathe. He would push and push to goad his students into achieving their potential. He would dismiss them when necessary as rishoyim, or boors, but only to the breaking point. When he saw they reached that point, he would immediately soften and bring them back. He would vary, for example, the aliyos during davening to encourage some, shlishi, tamp down others. A good Talmud, he'd give whatever, ruvi to. So he shouldn't be so haughty. He was a genius as a manager, knowing which Talmidim to bring close, which he can cut some slack, who needed harsh words, who needed gentle prodding. Rav Aaron Cutler, for example, frequently dined with the altar on Shabbos, because the altar felt he's such a genius, he needs to keep an eye on him. Or something I quoted for many years here. Slobodka did a haicha gedusha for mincha during the week. So it's not to be mevatel Torah. We know chazar sashatz. As happens, the serious students started a breakaway minyan. They want regular chazar sashatz. The altar set them straight and he said, conventional frumkeit is that the more one does, the better. Musa says something else. The better one does, the better. Better to daven a davening that's a davening and not just say more. A young Rabbi Chu Yaakov Weinberg is a great story. We'll be done in a minute. He once told the altar, when they're having their heart-to-heart talks, that he sometimes forgets to daven. Mincha. because he's so involved in the learning. Alta said, go tell this to Rav Naftali Amsterdam, who's a Talmud of Yisrael as well, one of three great Talmidim, who was in Slobodka at the time. So he went to Rav Naftali Amsterdam and confided and told him that he needs an Eitzah. Sometimes he forgets to daven Mincha. Rav Naftali looked at him astonished, and then with a horrified look on his face, you mean you forget to daven entirely? So Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg lied, and he said, no, he meant to say he forgets to daven with a minyan. Davens privately. So Rav Naftali made a suggestion. Yisridesh went back to the altar, told him a story, and the altar was furious. And he said to him, how could you have lied to that gadol? And he ordered him to go back to Rav Naftali and apologize for lying to him and tell him the truth. And Rav Chil Yaakov Weinberg refused and refused. And the altar told him, do not set foot in my home again until you apologize from Tali Amsterdam. With no choice, Rav Chil Yaakov left and he set out for Rav Tali's lodging. Before he got to the door, a Talmud grabbed him and said, the altar wants to speak to you before you go in. He came back and the altar said, I don't want to embarrass you. You don't have to talk to him. I only wanted to cleanse you of the filth of lying. And that was done by your walking to Rav Naftali and the trembling that you had, how to explain to him that you're a liar. You don't have to go. But the story is even better. The Sridi Yesh had first asked the Alta the question, what should he do? And the Alta said to him, go to Rav Naftali. Why didn't he give his own Eitzah, his own counsel? Because the Alta knew how Rav Naftali would respond. And the look of horror on his face, you don't daven mincha, the look of horror would be enough to set Rav Weinberg straight, to cure his defect. That is how you produce great people. Once the Chazon Ish heard the Alta give a Musar talk in Minsk, and he concluded, I'm opposed to Musar, but I'm even more opposed to opponents of Musar. What was his goal? Let's look at the last source, number 12. A group of maskilim came to the altar and said to him, what are you doing that's new? What are you innovating? So he said, I'm trying to do just one thing. Men soll sein klug und gut. I'm trying to produce people who are smart and good. And there you have the famous Musar line that's by being frum. The line goes, a galach is frum. A priest is frum. A Jew has to be erlich, be honest, be good. That's what a Jew is. With the move to Hebron in 1924, the Alta softened a bit. He held that the Torah of Eretz Yisrael allowed for a more congenial attitude, based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Chavdal Amad Aleph. Yeshiva expanded, and now had branches in Israel, and of course in Slobodka still. Sadly, the latter ceased to exist during the Holocaust, but the roots were planted in Israel. The Slobodka Yeshiva in Bnei Brak, and the Hebron Yeshiva, which moved to Yerushalayim in 1929 after 67 Jews were massacred by the Arabs in Hebron, including 24 Talmidim of the Yeshiva, and including 9 Talmidim who were Americans. The Alta did not live to see that. In 1926, in Israel, he suffered a serious stroke, and he was thereafter cared for around the clock by rotation of his faithful students. And he died the 22nd day of Shvat, 5687, 1927, age 78, buried in Har HaZeitim. His students were leaders in numerous yeshivos for the rest of the century, in Israel and America, in Tor Vadas, in Chaim Berlin, in Chafetz Chaim, in Ritz, Rabbi Shlomo Palachek, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Lessen became Mashgiach in Ritz, was a Slobodka. In Ner Yisrael, in Kletsk, in Lakewood, and Mir, where his son, Reb Lazy Yehuda, was Rosh Yeshiva. Kamenetz, his grandson, of course, Reb Nosli Finkel, Zatzal, died just a few years ago, was the Rosh Yeshiva in Mir, the one who suffered from Parkinson's for many years, and yet always had a smile on his face, and was always learning and engaged to meet him. The grandson is the same name, same temperament, same midos, same Mesiris Nefesh as the grandfather. They numbered in the thousands, all told, his Talmidim, and represent his legacy. He never wrote. His Torah was written up by his students, and the Muslim movement is no longer a vibrant part of the Jewish landscape. Regrettably so, but they shaped the Torah world of the 20th century in a most remarkable and enduring way. I thank you all very much. So next time, which is next month, we'll move into a different world entirely and look at part four, Great Rabbi of the 20th Century, HaChacham Ovad Yosef, and his accomplishments. That is next time. I thank you all once again.